First, a quirky tour of a few southern pastimes, from squirrel hunting and cockfighting to the roly-holers of Kentucky and Tennessee. Journalist Burkhard Bilger explores these traditions in Noodling for Flatheads. As he told Steve Paulson, his book's title refers to the practice of snaring catfish barehanded.
Noodling is this technique that people have been using for hundreds of years, where in the springtime you walk along a riverbank and the catfish are nesting there and protecting their eggs, and a noodler will just stick his arm into holes that seem likely and start wiggling his fingers, and if there's a big catfish inside, he'll basically bite your fingers. The noodler then will jam his arm down the fish's throat and basically spear him on his forearm and pull him out of the hole. So flathead catfish are a preferred fish for that kind of thing.
Now, I would imagine this could be kind of unnerving, because it's worth pointing out that when a catfish opens its mouth wide, its jaws are quite large, and it does have barbed teeth.
Yeah, and some of these fish, I mean, there was a champion catfish caught a couple years ago. It was 111 pounds. They're huge. They can pull you under. And the other thing is that noodlers are frightened of snapping turtles and cottonmouth snakes and all kinds of other things that nest in those same holes.
So you went out noodling yourself?
I did. I went to Arkansas first and hung out with a bunch of Arkansas noodlers, and that was less than successful. So I found this old high school buddy who I'd heard was just a champion noodler, and went out with him and actually caught a 25-pounder on my first try.
What was that like?
It was a little hard to describe because you don't see what's happening. You're sticking your arm into these holes, and then suddenly this enormous muscled gelatinous thing is clamped onto your fingers and onto your arm, and it's thrashing around, and people are screaming, and someone's jamming a rope in your hand and telling you to put it through its gills, and the whole thing is just slightly terrifying, slightly exhilarating, and, you know, it works.
Now, you write about a lot of different southern pastimes, and another one is squirrel hunting, which I gather is especially big in Kentucky, and you spent some time with a longtime squirrel hunter. Tell me what he was like.
He was an amazing man. He really was. He was not only a great squirrel hunter, but a fabulous thumb-style guitarist. He's from a county in Kentucky where thumb-style picking, like Merle Travis does, was born. And he was also an interesting man because he had kept on hunting these squirrels and eating their brains, even though there was a report in The Lancet, a medical journal, that said that there was a chance that squirrel brains might cause mad cow disease. And this guy basically spent a year worrying about it and then said, you know, forget it. I've been eating this stuff all my life, and I'm going to keep on doing it.
Now, this fellow that you hung out with, Steve Rector, once he shot the squirrels, how did he cook them?
Well, I wouldn't call him a great gourmet, but he had a technique which I guess a lot of squirrel hunters use, which is to coat it in flour. For some reason, he used self-rising flour. I have no idea why. And then fry it in a pan until it's brown. And then he would stick it in a pressure cooker and pressure cook it for about 20 minutes and throw in the stuff he called kitchen bouquet, which people might recognize. It's a brown substance that basically makes things brown and a little salty. And then he would pull it out. And the whole eating of the body, I mean, most of it just looks like chicken, but then you get the head, which really is an extraordinary thing. It looks like a big ant's head. And he would eat the cheeks off of it and pull out the tongue and eat the tongue. And then he would take a teaspoon and lift it up and just snap it very lightly on top of the skull, just like you were cracking a boiled egg, and peel off the skull and pull out this little pink and black brain and just pop that into his mouth.
Is that the great delicacy, the squirrel brain?
It is a great delicacy. I mean, there are people I talked to in Kentucky. You have to remember that squirrel hunting is a huge deal there. You know, something like 25 million squirrels get killed every year in Kentucky, Ohio, and Illinois alone, and there are about 3 million squirrel hunters. So it's a huge deal, and some of these people really think that the brain is by far the best, and they'll almost only eat that on a squirrel.
Now, there's another southern pastime that you investigated, cockfighting, which I hadn't realized is still legal in Louisiana.
Legal in Louisiana, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. Oklahoma, actually, it was almost voted out last year, and then the cockfighting lobby, which is pretty powerful, found a little glitch in the way they'd collected petition signatures, and they brought it back up again.
You write about different kinds of battle and cockfights. And some of these knives are actually strapped onto the gamecocks. How does that work?
There's a whole range going from Indians will wrap a foot in it like a boxing glove, and some will just strip the hide off of a spur on a natural chicken's foot. But the more popular fights nowadays, because they're over so quick and you can gamble on them so well, are knife fights that use either 1.5-inch razors, they're called Mexican knives, or 3.5-inch Filipino knives. And some of those in the Philippines are actually forged out of old army bullets.
What's the appeal here, do you think? Why do people like to see these chickens kill each other?
That depends on who's going. I think a lot of it in the small places really is just a sense of community. It's just like going to the high school football game. And in a way, it's all the tighter because it's looked down upon by some people, so it becomes a kind of a secret club. But I think the reason it's popular in the big pits, where you can win as much as $40,000 for having the winning chicken and a new car, is just the gambling aspect. I mean, people come there and bet thousands of dollars on these chickens. And it's, you know, if you like gambling, it's a lot more exciting than watching a slot machine.
Now, it sounds pretty brutal. Is there any effort to justify this sport from an animal rights perspective?
Oh, there's all kinds of wonderful lines of reasoning that the cockfighting lobby has developed. And some of it makes sense in a sense. You know, they'll say, well, you know, a chicken would much rather be a cock chicken, a game cock, than a chicken in a factory. They'll live 2 years on a game cock farm, or at least a year, whereas they'll live 6 weeks in a chicken factory. They'll say chickens kill each other anyway. These roosters are meant for this kind of thing. They're territorial. They're mean. You know, I think the bottom line reasoning is we were given dominion over the animals. It's a religious point which says these are for our use.
And there's one last bit of Southern culture that you write about that I want to ask you about, the roly-holers of Tennessee and Kentucky. Tell me about these guys.
They are probably the most astonishing people I saw on my trips for the book. They're the people who live in just two counties, one in Tennessee and one in Kentucky, and they're the last remnant of a marble-playing tradition that goes back to the Indians or before. And it's a game called Roly Hole, which is played on a big court about 20 feet long with three little indentations on it. And you play in teams of two, kind of making your way back and forth among these holes with your marble. And there's a lot of tactics involved because you have to try and knock the other marbles away from the holes as they're getting closer and so forth. And all that means is that the players, to become good, have to be astonishingly good at hitting accurately from a distance and for putting good spin on the ball, just like you would in pool. Some of these guys would take a half-inch diameter flint marble and could shoot from 25 feet dead on every time, with just enough English to make it roll as it bounced, you know, close to the hole next to it.
There's a great story of how two of England's best marble shooters, and it's worth pointing out that marbles are big in England and, in fact, in a lot of countries in Europe, but two of these British marble shooters came over to Tennessee to play a couple of the local roly-holers, and one of them was a 9-year-old kid. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, it was a funny situation because the English had the same kind of tradition that the Kentuckians and Tennesseans had, and they had never been defeated at their game, they said. And the folklorist in Kentucky who read about them in some international marble journal called them up and said, hey, we've got some good players down here. Why don't we come for a tournament and see who can win? And so this pair came of English champions and went to Kentucky at this tournament, and they spent about a weekend playing different versions of different games, and they played roly-hole against the roly-holers, and of course they lost that, but they thought that if they had a chance, it would be playing the English game, which is called ringer, which is a little bit like the standard marble game that we know, because that's their game, and the roly-holers had never played it. And when they picked people out of the hat to see who would face them, their opponents were this guy, Roy Thompson, who hadn't played in a few years, and his 9-year-old son, Nathan, who just looked like nothing. He was this plump little kid, very shy, hardly able to talk. And the English thought, okay, this is going to be a walkover. What they didn't know is that Nathan was just a genius of roly-hole. He's kind of a legend in those counties. From the age of 5 or 6, he'd already been taking guys on in these little parks at night. And he proceeded in the next 20 minutes to just tear through these English guys. They destroyed them like 25-7 or something like that. It was great. one of the great legends of the time.
Now, I understand there's a song that has some connection to the Roly-Holers. And now you have brought your guitar into the studio, and it's worth pointing out this is strictly a hobby for you, playing singing. But I'm wondering if you could sing a verse.
Sure. This is what this is. I mean, people might recognize this. It's a version of the Battle of New Orleans, a Jimmy Driftwood song that the folklorist in that area, Bob Fulcher, when the English were coming, he rewrote the lyrics to kind of play over the local radio stations to get people all excited about the tournament coming up. In 1991, when the British came across the great Atlantic Ocean just to see who was the boss, with a pocket full of marbles and a little bit of luck, they said they'd whoop old Tennessee and Taylor old Kentuck. We fired our flints and the British fired their tollies. We hit them before they hit us. Fired once more and we gave them such a volley that we busted all their marbles and we left them in the dust.
Burkhardt Bilger writes about Roly-Holers and other Southerners in Noodling for Flatheads. He talked with Steve Paulson.